So we're very pleased today we have Professor Gray Worcester from DAMPT, and he's going to talk to us about the dynamics of marine ice sheets. So welcome, thank you very much for coming.
So thank you very much. It's very nice to be here again. I did speak in engineering apparently not so long ago, and I didn't look back to see what I'd spoken about then. Apparently I spoke about this, so I hope not too many people have heard what I'm going to say today, but there is some new stuff towards the end in case you did. This was a whole area of research that began about 12 years ago, as far as I was concerned, with an undergraduate project. The undergraduate was Rosie Robeson, and she spent a summer vacation working with Herbert Huppert and myself on a new area of fluid mechanical research. And the nice thing with undergraduate projects is it doesn't matter if they go wrong. And so you can try out crazy ideas and see if they go anywhere. And this was an idea that went somewhere and then led on to research that was picked up by postdocs, Rich Katz and Roy Saig, and students Sam Pegler, Martin Waring, and Katarzyna Kowal. There's a broad range of work, and I will only touch on a little bit of it today. So I'm going to talk about marine ice sheets. Marine ice sheets are glacial ice sheets, the sort of thing that covers Greenland and Antarctica. Greenland is mostly what's called a terrestrial ice sheet. It terminates on land. But Antarctica, West Antarctica in particular, is a marine ice sheet, and it terminates as a floating ice shelf. And here you're seeing the front of a floating ice shelf. These white cliffs here are about 50 meters high. And remember that only 10% of ice floats above the surface of the water. So this ice sheet here is about half a kilometer thick. We're going to treat it as a thin sheet. And the reason it's thin is because the dimensions going in the horizontal direction here are tens to hundreds to thousands of kilometers. So the sheet is a kilometer or so, a few kilometers, up to a few kilometers thick, but many hundreds of kilometers long. Ice, we probably think of as a solid in most of our lives, the sort of thing you put in your gin and tonic on a Friday evening. And indeed, the front of this ice shelf looks very fractured, sort of behavior you'd expect of a brittle, elastic solid. Although, in a different talk, we now feel that many of these features might be explainable with viscous fluid rheology, but that's another story. I'm going to be talking today about much longer length scales and much longer time scales of decades to centuries to millennia. The average transit time from a snowflake landing somewhere in the central Antarctic to getting to the shore is about 10,000 years. Okay, so very slow creeping flow, and on those slow flows we can treat and large length scales compared with individual ice crystals, ice flows as a viscous fluid, and we're going to take that perspective. So why is this interesting? What are the sort of issues that we're concerned about? The main one is the potential influence on sea level rise of a collapse of marine ice sheets. So this shows a decade's worth of sea level rise in the 1990s, essentially, running at about 3 millimeters a year. And that rate is carrying on and is roughly what's predicted over the next 100 years. Okay, but that forward prediction is based on atmospheric warming, melting of glaciers in the Himalayas, melting of Greenland, and so on and so forth. So if the predicted global atmospheric warming happens, then that's how much runoff we'd expect. But you'll see that most of the rise in sea level comes simply from the thermal expansion of the oceans. Okay, you can do that calculation quite easily. What the predictions ignore, very deliberately, because the state of science was not sufficient, was any potential collapse of the ice sheets. We know that there's an enormous amount of water stored in the ice sheet. So in the West Antarctic ice sheet, that's what this stands for, just in the West Antarctic ice sheet, there's enough water to raise global sea level by about 5 meters. If you look at the whole of Antarctica, it's about 70 meters, but it's the West Antarctic ice sheet, as we'll see, which is the most vulnerable to the sorts of fluid mechanics that we're going to talk about. So I mentioned that on large scales, ice really behaves as a viscous fluid, and you might get that impression from this cross-section over the East Antarctic ice sheet over here, because in cross-section, although there's a lot of rough topography, this is about 4 to 5 kilometers we're looking in thickness here, but this surface here is really very smooth, and I hope gives you the impression of essentially a gravity current or puddle of viscous fluid just flowing over the bedrock. Okay, and say that flow takes about 10,000 years in there if you look at the typical strain rates. Okay, now it flows as a viscous fluid but not as a Newtonian fluid, and ice is mostly modeled as a non-Newtonian shear thinning fluid, specifically a power law fluid, and we'll say precisely what I mean by that in just a moment. But for most of this talk, I'm going to argue that we don't need to worry about that, that actually we can learn some fundamental controls on the ice sheet by considering Newtonian fluids. And I want, just by way of an example, to contrast a gravity current on the left of golden syrup, which on the laboratory scales is nice and Newtonian with a constant viscosity, and on the right, a similar flow of xanthan solution, which is a polymer, which as a polymer solution acts as a shear thinning fluid with, in this case, a power exponent of about 6. Ice is typically modeled with a power law exponent of about 3. And first of all, first thing to notice is just simply that there isn't any obvious qualitative difference between these two flows. Quantitatively, we can look in a bit more detail. We're going to be working with these as viscous fluids, so we have the usual stress-strain relationship for a viscous fluid. So this is the stress tensor, the isotropic pressure term, and then the viscous term coming from strain. But in the power law, we would write this viscosity as a power of the strain rate, and there's a convenient invariant of the strain rate tensor. We just take the double inner product of the strain rate tensor with itself, raise it to some power, and that gives us a measure. Think of this E being the square root of E double dot E. And viscosity, the important thing is viscosity decreases with strain rate. So as we try and stretch this ice or shear it, again on very slow creeping timescales, its viscosity reduces. So what's the effect of that? We're going to be looking essentially at a gravity current type of flow where its gradients in hydrostatic pressure, so the density, acceleration due to gravity times the slope in the surface elevation, dH by dr, if we're thinking of radial geometry, that pressure gradient, hydrostatic pressure gradient being balanced by vertical shear stresses. So very typical of viscous flow in a thin film. Okay. And this is roughly the profile that you would get for a Newtonian fluid with constant viscosity. Constant viscosity, you can see we've just got the second derivative of u is related to something that's essentially independent of z. We can integrate that to give us a parabolic or Poisson profile. If we add in the shear thinning rheology, power law rheology, that changes, watch this picture, to that. And again, qualitatively it's not changed very much. It's a little bit more uniform in the upper regions. The shear is concentrated near the base, but essentially we've got the same topological style of flow. We can take that velocity field, integrate it in the vertical to find a volume flux, put that volume flux into an equation of conservation, mass conservation, and we end up with this rather ghastly looking equation. But it's not actually that ghastly if you stare at it for long enough. It's essentially a diffusion equation, dH by dt is d by dr of dh by dr. Okay, so a diffusion equation, dh by dt related to the second derivative of h. And what clutters it up is the fact we've got this shear thinning fluid with lots of n's all over the place. So it's hard sometimes to see the wood for the trees, which is another reason I like to work with Newtonian fluids. The maths is just less cluttered and you can sort of see what's going on more easily and get an understanding. But does this make a quantitative difference? We can run the experiment that I just showed you, circular release, constant flux release. You can make predictions, compare with experiments, which is very good. What you find in both cases is that the radius increases to some power of time, and that power can be determined in terms of the rheological parameter, the power that appears up here. And when, for a Newtonian fluid, n is equal to 1, and you arrive at alpha is a half, spreads like t to the half, if you go all the way to n equals infinity, which is sometimes known as a perfect plastic, so that's as shear thinning as you can get, then this exponent changes from 0.5 to 0.4. So again, very little quantitative difference and little or no qualitative difference. So we're going to take that line. We're going to use Newtonian fluid mechanics to try and get an understanding of what's going on. I want to move your attention now to West Antarctica, and this is very different from East Antarctica by virtue of the fact that the bedrock in this cross-section, apart from this mountain range, is mostly below sea level. So on average, West Antarctica has a bedrock that's 2 kilometres below sea level. On the other hand, you've got roughly 4 kilometres of ice sitting on it. The weight of the ice keeps it in contact with the bedrock. On the other hand, it's going to spread like a gravity current. As it spreads, it thins, and eventually it gets thin enough that it can float on the ocean to form an ice shelf. And that was the very first photograph that we looked at. And what's of interest is this locus here, the locus of detachment from when the ice sheet changes from being grounded to being floating on the ocean, a floating ice shelf. So this is now the applied mathematician's picture of what's going on. We have a grounded ice sheet going into a floating ice shelf across what's called the grounding line, so this locus of detachment. And the important difference between terrestrial ice sheets like Greenland that I mentioned and marine ice sheets is that for terrestrial ice sheets, the global mass balance is between snowfall inland at high elevations and melting towards the coast or the margins of the ice sheet and at low elevations where things are warmer. So things will have melted by here if we were sitting on land. With the marine ice sheet, the dominant mass balance is between snowfall inland at high elevations, flow, transition to an ice shelf, and eventually the calving of icebergs which float off into warmer oceans and melt. So this is less about thermodynamics and much more about dynamics. And in particular, what's the dynamical control on the position of the grounding line? So let's go back, just a quick statement. Ice flows as a non-Newtonian shear thinning fluid, as I've said. Ice modelers usually use something called Glenn's flow law, which is essentially thin film lubrication theory, with a power law fluid with an exponent of 3, but we're going to treat the whole system as being Newtonian. So here's the undergraduate experiment. You can see that, I'm just getting ready here. Let's watch it for a bit, I'll stop it and then talk. So what you can see is that it's snowing inland at high elevations. It's forming a grounded ice sheet, eventually coming into the ocean, and at this stage it's formed a cliff, just a vertical ice wall into the ocean. And that will happen at shallow depths when the hydrostatic pressure of the ocean is not sufficient to hold this back. We're going to use the word buttressing later on, and to some extent you can think of the hydrostatic pressure in the ocean providing a sort of limited buttressing. Let's run that a little longer. And about now, we're going deeper ocean, going to see a detachment, the formation of an ice shelf, and a grounding line that's continuing to evolve. And the challenge is to predict the evolution of the position of this grounding line, to develop the equations that are needed to model of all of this, and then ultimately to use those equations in the context of geophysical settings, actual ice sheets, to see if we can make predictions about them. Just an experimental detail, clearly this is not ice because it flows rather too slowly. We don't have 10,000 years to wait for the experiment. This is golden syrup. It forms a viscous, it's a viscous fluid which forms this gravity current. Floating on an ocean, ocean needs to be denser than ice. This needs to be denser than golden syrup, and this was made dense with potassium carbonate. Golden syrup is quite dense, it's about 1.4 in density, and you can't get that dense with sodium chloride, unfortunately. So that's a detail. Okay, so what about modeling? So this is now what our experiment looks like schematically. We have a grounded sheet of viscous fluid flowing across a grounding line at xg. That's going to be an important variable in our problem, forming a floating shelf, and the floating of it is represented by this Archimedes relationship, which says that the weight of the viscous fluid, density times its thickness, is balanced by the Archimedes upthrust, the depth of the water displaced, which is B times the density of the water. So this is a problem in two halves. The sheet we've already looked at, that's a classical gravity current, in this case on a satisfying a no-slip condition at the base. Because we're now thinking of a Newtonian fluid, we have a parabolic profile. The integration of this dynamic equation, balancing, as I said, the hydrostatic pressure gradient with the viscous shear stress. And then the continuity equation, which in shorthand would be the rate of change of thickness, is the divergence of the flux. And the flux in here is the integrated velocity profile, is proportional to the cube of the thickness times the surface elevation gradient. Okay. So if you've done any viscous fluid mechanics in thin films, you may recognize this equation as being quite classical. The shelf has an entirely different character. This is very viscous. I mean, here we've used golden syrup in the laboratory. It's about 10,000 times more viscous than water or so. And ice is many more orders of magnitude more viscous than either air or ocean. So it's a very viscous fluid, which means that to leading order, there is no stress exerted by the air or the ocean on the flow of ice, which means that there is no vertical shear. You have a uniform flow of ice. On the other hand, gradients in the hydrostatic forcing can lead to a straining flow, like pulling out a piece of toffee. Okay. So to leading order, the ice flows uniformly, but relative to that uniform flow, there is a straining, a stretching. And so there's a different dynamical equation now balancing the hydrostatic pressure gradient, modified by the fact that we're floating on the ocean. So this G primed is G times delta rho over rho, density difference between ice and water over the density of the water. So a reduced gravity, reduced driving force, and now an extensional viscosity, a viscous term. So this is like one-dimensional Stokes flow in some sense. Du by dx, u is in the x direction, du by dx gives you the stretch. We want to multiply by the thickness because the thicker sheet will be harder to stretch than a thin sheet. And then we take the divergence of that stress to balance the hydrostatic pressure gradient. Okay. So this is our dynamical equation. And we couple that with the usual continuity equation, rate of change of thickness plus the divergence of the flux is equal to zero. So our mathematical model has changed from essentially a diffusion equation, one parabolic equation, if you like to use that terminology, into a pair of equations, one of which is elliptic, so like the Poisson's equation, if you like, second derivative related to a forcing term, and a hyperbolic wave-like equation. Moving. So mathematically, the challenge is to couple what's happening on this side with these equations to what's happening on these sides through these equations, and that happens through some transition region around the grounding line. The first thing to note about the grounding line is it's the place where the ice first begins to float. So what I've written at the top is just the Archimedes flotation condition. It's rearranged in a way that perhaps is less familiar than it might be, but it's essentially saying that the weight of the ice is balanced by the Archimedes upthrust. And I've written it at the grounding line, which is, in general, a function of time. So we have a thickness, which is a function of position and time, but the grounding line position can change with time. From here to here is a simple application of the chain rule. So I differentiate both sides with respect to time, get the partial derivative of the thickness with respect to x times the motion of the grounding line, and then the rate of change of h. So this is the thinning or thickening of ice at the grounding line. And this is related to the bed slope. B is the position below sea level of the bedrock, and so at the bed slope multiplying the migration of the grounding line. That's one condition. It's not sufficient to close the problem mathematically. There needs to be something else. There's another physical condition that needs to be applied, and that's a condition that the longitudinal force is balanced across that grounding zone. And I'm not going to show all the guts of this. So here is the equation, and I'll simply point out that within the sheet there is a viscous term, notice the dynamic viscosity coming in here, related to the divergence of the flux. So there's a viscous term and a hydrostatic pressure term. In the shelf, there is no viscous term, and that's because the viscosity of the shelf only acts to limit the stretching of this toffee, if you like. What it doesn't do is provide any back resistance on the grounding line. So if we thought of the whole shelf as a big slab, it's sitting on ocean, which is essentially inviscid, and underneath air, which is essentially inviscid. So there are no external forces on this slab. I could blow on it and it would waft into the ocean. Okay. So there's no viscous contribution coming from the shelf. And we can put all this together via the continuity equation, the rate of thinning or thickening, balancing the divergence in the flux. And let's just walk this through quickly. We've got two terms related to the motion of the grounding line, xg dot, and they're put here, equals something related to dh dt. Dh dt is related to dq dx, and this boundary condition gives me dq dx in terms of the thickness of the sheet h and the surface elevation gradient dh dx. So you see this term coughing down to here and this term down into here. So we put that together and we now have a dynamic evolution equation for the position of the grounding line. So in principle we can solve our equations, both sides, we know how to evolve this moving boundary within that system. And that gives us these solutions, and they look very appealing and rather like the experiment. And in particular, what you see is that early times we're in shallow water, we end with a cliff edge, no shelf there, but around this time you just start to begin to see the evolution of a shelf, which then grows. Ultimately, the grounding line reaches a steady state, but the ice continues to flow through the grounding line into the shelf, continues to grow. So this is very pretty. Problem is, it doesn't agree with the experiments, and I'll show you that comparison a little later on. The bigger problem with it is it doesn't phenomenologically agree with what we see in nature. And it all comes back to the fact that I mentioned just now that this shelf, we've done this all in two dimensions, this shelf has no external forces acting on it. Everything's in balance and it can just waft off into the ocean. It doesn't do anything to this grounding line. Mathematically, the problem on the right is equivalent to the problem on the left. I can chop the shelf off and it makes no difference to the problem. All this shelf does is to transmit the hydrostatic pressure in the ocean back to the grounding line. So we can chop it off and just apply the hydrostatic pressure at that grounding line position. Okay. Now, this isn't what's observed in practice. You'll remember, I think it was 2002, there was a big collapse of the Larsen B ice shelf. Last year, there was a lesser collapse of part of the Larsen C ice shelf. It's a bit too recent to know what the consequences of that might be. But the collapse of the Larsen B ice shelf caused the ice sheet that was feeding it to accelerate and thin. And it's that which contributes to sea level rise. Okay. The shelf doesn't matter. That can break off and float in the ocean. Nothing's changed because this was floating in the ocean anyway. But if taking this away causes the ice behind it to accelerate and thin, then we're taking ice off the bedrock and putting it into the ocean, and that causes sea level rise. Okay. So this two-dimensional problem, which we've nicely solved, got these beautiful solutions, doesn't have any of this behavior in it. Another reason for going further is to really examine something called the grounding line instability. I'm not sure about this acronym anymore. Anyway, grounding line instability. So this relates to whether, I showed you an evolving system. Actually, that was new mathematics. Before that, people had looked at steady states and ask the question, not mathematically, but qualitatively, what's that steady state stable? If you move the grounding line a little bit, would it run away with itself? Okay. Now, we can get to that question a little bit, even with the model that I've just shown you. Here is the expression again. I've rearranged it slightly. I've divided through by the coefficient of xg dot, put it in the denominator here. But first of all, in steady state, grounding line is not moving. These two terms must balance. Don't know how much you can do quickly in your head. If you balance these two terms, we can tease out dh by dx, and we find that at the grounding line in steady state, it's just given by this constant ratio of the reduced gravity to gravity, square root of that. Okay. So if we look at the steady flux. The flux, remember, is proportional to the cube of the thickness times the gradient of the surface elevation. And that surface elevation we've just found is a constant. So what we find is that the steady flux across a grounding line is, in this model, proportional to h cubed. And h, because of the flotation condition itself, is related to the cube of the depth of water that we're going into. Now, this is all for no-slip Newtonian fluids, etc., etc., but you can do more detailed calculations with different boundary conditions, slippy boundary conditions, for example, with different rheologies. They all come up with qualitatively the same answer, that the flux increases with the depth of fluid that it's going into. And that sort of qualitatively has been known at least since the 70s, and there's an argument which is due to Wirtmann, 1974, paper in 1974, basically goes as follows. If we take a law like this, where the flux increases with the depth of fluid, then if we have a steady position and the grounding line position advances a little bit downslope, then we're going into deep water, so the thickness of the grounding line increases. That causes the flux to increase. The faster flux of ice through here is going to cause the ice to thin behind. That sheet thins, and with a thinner sheet, the grounding line retreats, okay, coming back to this relationship. So if we're going downslope, it seems that the grounding line is stable. On the other hand, we can reverse the argument for if we're going on an upward slope, then everything is opposite. We advance the grounding line, we go into shallower water, thickness of the grounding line decreases, the flow across here decreases, and so the sheet thickens, and with a thicker sheet, the grounding line advances. Okay? And that's unstable. And that's a problem, because many of the grounding lines in Antarctica sit on these reverse slopes. And the reason for that is because there's a lot of weight in Antarctica. It's been sitting there for tens of thousands, if not millions of years. Okay, and it's pushed the bedrock down. So below Antarctica, you're essentially sitting in a bowl, and the grounding line's sitting inside that bowl. Okay? And yet the ice sheet has been sitting there quite happily for quite some time. So what I'll argue towards the end, and we'll get there fairly soon, is that it's the wrong question, actually. So first of all, we need to modify our model to say why it is that Antarctica is pretty stable, and then what we really need to worry about. So here's a map of the surface velocity of Antarctica. Okay. So it's a sort of color temperature map. So the redder colors, purpley red colors, are fast. The browns and greens and yellows are slow. And the fastest moving ice are in floating ice shelves. So the big ones in West Antarctica are the Ronny Ice Shelf here and the Ross Ice Shelf down here. Very large areas of ice, all floating. And what you notice is that all this floating ice, all these ice shelves around here, are confined. They're laterally confined by slow-moving ice, sometimes by rock, but often just by slow-moving ice. Okay, so what does that confinement do? Coming back to our experiments, you realize that it was a quasi-two-dimensional experiment, but you have to do it in a finite tank. And there are going to be sidewalls. And those sidewalls can exert a stress. Now, normally, if you do a two-dimensional gravity current experiment, what you worry about is dissipation over the thickness of the current, the depth of the current. So if my sidewalls are appreciably far apart compared with the thickness of my current, I can ignore the sidewall effect. Okay, so that's fine for the grounded part of the sheet. Once it's floating, we've said there are no vertical stresses. And then anything is bigger than zero. So any weak horizontal stress coming from even distant sidewalls has an effect on the dynamics of the floating shelf. So in these regions, which you know have order one aspect ratio, nevertheless, these sidewalls are going to have a leading order effect on what's happening in here. So I'm not going to go into this in a lot of detail. Here is the sort of simple model we end up with, and it is a very simple model. In the ice shelf, ice sheet, the grounded part, we have no slip at the base, and we have vertical shear through the ice and a vertical shear stress, which dominantly balances the hydrostatic pressure gradient. And the flow, to all intents and purposes, is uniform across the flow. Okay, you'll get a little bit of adjustment at sidewalls, but it doesn't matter. In the floating part, if you remember, we had no vertical shear because we're essentially inviscid above and below, but because of the sidewalls, we now have horizontal shear. Here is a more refined version of the experiment I showed you earlier. This is now in a tank that's some 2 meters long and 20 centimeters wide, with the current being a few centimeters. That's a wide tank compared to its depth. On the other hand, if anyone's played with gravity currents before, you'll notice this triangular shape is what you'd expect to see in a Healy-Shaw cell. A Healy-Shaw cell is a fluid cell where you have closely spaced walls such that you're dominated by the shear stress across between the walls. And that's what you're getting here. You've got a 20 centimeter wide Healy-Shaw cell, in effect, okay, where you're dominated by the horizontal shear. And that leads to a very simple description, much simpler even than the two-dimensional model that I showed you earlier, where you just have a parabolic profile balancing the hydrostatic gradients with the horizontal shear stresses. Y is the direction across here. Now, there's a lot of detail in this region. There's a whole transition region where we have to move immediately across the grounding line. You will get these extensional toffee-like flows. Okay? I'm ignoring those. They form a sort of boundary layer roughly the size of this thickness, but this thickness is only a couple of kilometers at most, whereas this distance is 100 kilometers. Okay? So I'm going to ignore that boundary layer. In consequence, I can't insist on continuity of thickness. So you can think of that discontinuity in thickness in this model as being the transition across an extensionally dominated boundary layer. And that detail can be looked at, but is unimportant. Okay. And here's the result. So essentially it's the same model before. I haven't gone through and redone all the analysis, but this is the same equation that we saw before for the motion of the grounding line, except now that there's this term in red, and that term in red is the integrated shear stress on the sidewalls. This is the effect of the sidewalls. Okay. And it looks like this term, but there's an H plus rather than H, and H is the thickness of the ice sheet at the grounding line. H plus is the thickness of the ice shelf, so you come back towards the transition zone. So the difference between H and H plus is this difference in thickness across the transition zone, which is taken as a discontinuity. Okay. Turns out to be negligible. One can show that mathematically, demonstrated experimentally. So here are some experiments. This is the experiments that I just showed in the video. This is the position of the nose of the floating shelf, and this is the position of the grounding line. The dashed lines here are the results of the model I first introduced you to, that beautiful model that gave us qualitative pictures that looked very nice, and they're not even close. Okay. But if we include this weak horizontal shear stress coming from the sidewalls, then we've got really very good agreement with the experiments. So why is this important? It's important because anything that restrains the ice shelf communicates a stress back to the grounding line. And that causes the grounding line to advance, in principle, or it counteracts a retreat. And I had meant to point out the fact that there's a plus sign here. So that red term by itself is causing advance of the grounding line or counteracting a potential retreat. So back stresses can occur in a variety of ways. It can come from horizontal shear stresses because of sidewalls, as I've mentioned. It can also come from the fact that the bedrock is not completely flat, not like in our experiments, and there are things called ice rises, and they often pin ice shelves. So this picture from here to here is roughly what's going on at Pine Island Glacier, which is in West Antarctica. It's the area of most rapid thinning in the Antarctic, contributing most to sea level rise currently. And what seems to be going on there is that the ice used to be scraping along the top of a rise in the bedrock. That causes a stress, what those equations did, those one-dimensional equations, is they transmit stress. So what this shelf is good at doing is transmitting stress back from any obstacle or back from the sidewalls onto the grounding line. Now you come along with a little bit of global warming, a little bit of warming of the ocean, and you can melt a bit of the underside of this ice shelf and release it from pinning points like this. So you take away that stress, this grounding line retreats and the ice sheet behind it thins and we get contributions to sea level. And so going back to the ice grounding line instability, it is the wrong question. It's not, the question is not, is this steady grounding line stable to small perturbations, but how does the system respond if the shelf collapses or the friction acting on that shelf is lessened? Okay, and that's a very different sort of question. So you get something like happened at Larsen B, where a large chunk of the shelf simply broke away, fractured, and went into the ocean. We suddenly take away this buttressing, and immediately after that, the ice sheet behind it accelerates and thins, pours water into the ocean, raises sea level. Okay? So the question which we haven't got an answer for really is, can that ice shelf recover? Once I collapse the ice shelf, okay, it's going to be discharging ice into the ocean. Does it discharge ice in a fragmented way that will cause the grounding line to continue to retreat? Or can somehow it get accumulated and stuck in a bay long enough to form a consolidated ice shelf again and restore the buttressing? So that brings me to the end. Just in summary, we've seen on continental length and time scales, these ice sheets and shelves can flow as viscous gravity currents. They are non-Newtonian in practice, but the non-Newtonianness is a detail to many extents. One can understand the underlying dynamics perfectly well using Newtonian rheology. We've got this difference between a grounded ice sheet and a floating two-dimensional ice shelf, where in the grounded ice sheet you're balancing hydrostatic pressure gradients with vertical shear, and in the floating horizontal shelf, you're balancing those hydrostatic pressure gradients with extensional stresses. On the other hand, what we've seen is actually those extensional stresses are really rarely the things that dominate the system dynamics, because in three dimensions, which is what we all live in, actually a much more significant player are the horizontal stresses, which can buttress the ice sheet. And in a different talk, I might have mentioned hoop stresses that can happen in a diverging situation where the ice has to spread as well as travel. And those hoop stresses can also act to buttress ice sheets. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. That was really interesting. Has anyone got any questions?
I presumably the melting of, if you've got your ice shelf in a warm ocean, the melting, its effect on this grounding line, is that second order in this?
So as always in these sorts of things, you tell sort of white lies along the way. So we ignored melting entirely as a dynamical process. And I said, you know, the dominant balance was mechanical. Actually, in many places, it's about 50-50 between melting and dynamics. So one does have to worry about that melting as it comes on. But I think the thing I wanted to emphasize is the fact that the melting really has an effect on depinning as being a primary mechanism for potential collapse.
That was a fantastic talk, Ray. You were making me think that Trump should be thinking about building a wall around the top.
That was very good.
Do you think you could artificially buttress an ice shelf?
Oh, goodness me. It's just an engineering department, isn't it? Like a sapper, we can get in there. I don't know. I mean, it's not a stupid question because, as I say, once you've collapsed, what can you do? And, you know, in some sense, once it is, I should have brought some pictures of collapsed ice shelves because it tends to fragment. And then what you've got sitting in the ocean is really a granular medium if you look down from it above. And then it's a question of whether that granular medium can sort of coalesce and form enough temporary consolidation, if you like, for things to freeze and really cement itself together. So given that these are floating, rather dramatically said you could blow and it would waft into the ocean, it mightn't take too much, actually, to constrain that granular medium for a time to allow it to self-consolidate. I don't think you would want to go in and, as it were, build a medieval buttress wall against your grounding line.
Well,
but you could use the debris, as it were, from possibly.
I was thinking before collapse. So on the diagram you drew, you had the topology coming up and supporting it.
Oh, I see.
What if on a colossal scale, it would be an enormous project, you could put floating buoys of a sort underneath it to recreate that? Would that, do you think that would?
I'm going to hesitate to answer that one, I think. It's a nice idea.
I actually had the same question, because the forces are quite small, I suppose. The actual force, you've got here an enormous Poiseuille flow, 100 kilometres wide.
Yeah, yeah.
So d2 udy squared is a small number.
It is a small number. Of course, the viscosity is huge.
Yeah.
And so more relevant, I've done it, obviously in the laboratory, we've got no slip sidewalls. Actually, there's a lot of fracturing that goes on at the sidewalls. In practice, you have a very broken margin. A better boundary condition would be more like a Coulomb friction law. And then it's, it's all down to the coherence of your...
I was thinking of
edges.
An enormous 100 kilometre long steel cable.
Yes.
It may not even have to be that thick.
Well, it may not be. But again, it might be that you can use some of this, the debris, as it were, to help you, because what you'd really like is for it to sort of freeze together and form its own consolidated mass.
So this is a perfect Hugh Hunt project, I think.
Yes. Well, he could spray more water over the top of it.
That's right.
Are there any more questions?
Your picture of Antarctica, there were not everything was buttressed at the side.
No, there are some very interesting features.
Mertz and David and Will.
Yeah, Mertz is a very, so there's what's called an ice tongue. So if you want to, this is a very nice candidate for looking at the two-dimensional solution we looked at earlier. And I don't know why it is that sometimes ice tongues, this flowed out of this region, you could think of it as a fjord coming out here, and the ice has just continued and for some reason has not fractured, not broken off, and just formed a tongue of ice that's gone out into the ocean. So there are places like that. This is another area we've looked at. Again, in a different talk, I would have focused on this edge. There's a big crack that comes in the front of that. And that's, if you look here, it sort of has a bulge, and that's diverging, and that's when I mentioned hoop stresses. But there's a very interesting instability, which we've just submitted yesterday for critical review. Where we believe that actually the instability that leads to that sort of cracking, the sort of cracks that I showed you in the very first photograph, can be described using viscous rheology. Don't need to get into brittle elastic rheologies. So, no, but you're quite right. There are these few areas where it can come out.
Okay, well, I think we'll leave it there. Thank you again very much. That's really sweet.